Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Welcome to Vox Novus, the new voice. If you light a lamp for someone else, it will also brighten your own path. These words have been attributed to the Buddha, but the actual source is unknown. The truth in the statement is self-evident. May this same wisdom be applied to the words we share with others. Is the act of sharing our most life-giving stories with others not only illuminating for them, but also for us? My guest this week on Vox Novus, Dr. Diane Millis, says that there is power in sharing our most life-giving stories. Diane holds a BA and an MA in Communication Studies and a PhD in Family Studies from the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. Since completing her doctorate, she has studied theology and trained in spiritual direction, retreat direction, and the practice of interfaith dialogue. Diane has taught at a number of schools, including the University of Minnesota, the College of St. Benedict, St. John's University, and St. Catherine University. She currently teaches at United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. She is the co-founder of Companions on a Journey at the College of St. Benedict, funded by the Lilly Endowment, and the Journey Conversations Project. She served as host and producer of Lives Explored for the Collegeville Institute. Diane has also served as a coach and consultant for the Lilly Endowment, working with leadership teams at colleges, universities, and theological schools throughout the United States. Her website is dianemillis.com, and she joins me this week to share her path and her book, Recreating a Life, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story. Please join me in welcoming to Vox Novus, Dr. Diane Millis. Welcome, Diane.
Well, thank you, Victor. It's a pleasure to be with you. I look forward to our conversation.
I do too. Diane, please share with our listeners your story and how your path led to the work and your calling.
Well, how much time did you say we had?
As much as you need.
Well, you know, as I remind readers and as I remind students and retreat participants, none of us lives a single story. And so there are many possible ways that I might respond to your question. I think for the purposes related to the book, I found myself for many years telling what Dan McAdams at Northwestern University would refer to as a contamination story. It was not a life-giving story. It was a story that went like this, that I was living a really wonderful life until I was 10 years old, and my parents informed us they were divorcing, and my mother made the decision to relocate to another part of the country, which I now understand was a very life-giving decision for her. However, for me at the time, being 10, it required me leaving the state where all my extended family lived in Minnesota. It required me leaving my beloved Catholic school, where I felt a great sense of belonging on many levels. And so within a matter of months, I went from being a little girl who had a pretty good sense of belonging and a pretty good sense of confidence to feeling like a refugee in a new state and in a new place and away from my father and extended family. And so, you know, looking back now, I'm in my late 50s. I'd say of all the challenging things that might happen to a little girl, this probably is far from the most traumatic, but that's the only thing that little girl knew at the time. And it was quite a significant loss. And I noticed that throughout the past decades, I've always held up what I've referred to as a phantom story. You know, just how people who have lost a limb talk about the phenomenon of a phantom limb. They still experience pain from where that piece of their body was. And I noticed I still experienced pain. I was always comparing the story that I might have lived had my parents not divorced and had we been able to stay in the part of the country and the beautiful container I love so much as this little girl in a Catholic school. And so when I learned the work of Dan McAdams on the nature of stories and that we've got a couple of things that can happen, he's looked at high points and low points in our lives. And he says, he reminds us that some people, they experience a really low point, like the example I just gave you, but yet they find redemptive meaning in it. So it may take a lot of time for them to gain a sense of redemptive meaning, or it may be that over time, things just naturally get better in their new circumstances. There are various ways that redemptive meaning may emerge. But he talks then about a second way that we tell stories, and that's contamination stories. And so here people will talk about their life was good until X or Y occurred, and then it was never the same. And they felt like they never recovered. And so after reading Dan McAdams, this naming, this distinction between the different types of stories we tell, it dawned on me, as somebody who had a PhD by that time, it was a big insight. It's like, girlfriend, you're telling yourself a contamination story. And so what are more redemptive ways of making meaning of this? And it's not that I had such a limited sense of my life, but I could just tell there was still a need for far deeper healing and for you know, discerning how to let go of that phantom life and live more fully into the life I've been given. So that's a distinction I found immensely helpful. When I look at other challenges in my life, because certainly my parents divorcing and what I just narrated is not the only challenge that I've experienced, but it did prove to be significant. And so I find this distinction of redemptive story versus contamination story helpful. Maybe we can talk more about that, but for me, the subtitle of the book, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story, is really my journey of learning how to tell a more redemptive story.
Absolutely. And before we get into the context of the book, let's talk a little bit more about your life and some of the previous works that you did. So how did you get involved in theology and in the work that you're doing?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Well, you know, as an undergrad, I studied communication studies, and I think in large part, I think so much of the work that I've felt called to address is a way to heal with what I experienced in my family. So I hoped that no other parents would ever get divorced. And so I studied interpersonal communication. And then I went on to study family communication, and I went on to teach courses in marriage and family spirituality. So a large part of my work was addressing that wound and hoping that other people wouldn't experience that wound. So there's a logic in that, I guess. And then after I finished my doctorate, I myself had been on a parallel journey throughout graduate school, although I was at a public university and I had a phenomenal experience at the University of Minnesota. I had really wonderful professors, had a great opportunity to serve as a teaching assistant and get a lot of very meaningful teaching experience. But I was a closet mystic along the way. So any spare moment I had, I was reading the mystics. And in large part because my tradition is Christian, they were the mystics in the Christian tradition. And so I felt like I had these two paths that my life was moving on. And so when I finished my doctorate in the early 90s, And our son was born. I took a year off and I just thought, I'm going to find a way to integrate these two paths in my life. And so I thought, well, family studies, and I love spirituality, maybe I can forge a specialization in family spirituality. And it was at that point then my teaching and my scholarship turned into the area of theology.
Wonderful. Let's talk about your previous books. In 2013, you published your first book, Conversations, The Sacred Art. Please tell us about that book.
So when I was in graduate school, and I taught for a number of years courses like interpersonal communication and small group communication, and I already mentioned the work on family. So I was always looking at this dimension of intimacy. And at the core level, my assumption was, you know, this is the deepest form of communion. Now, I know the way that term is used in my Catholic tradition as a sacrament. And I also believe that encounters between people are potentially sacramental. And so I was looking to explore, after many years studying and teaching communication as a social science, I was looking to integrate what I was learning about the spirituality of communication, of conversation, and drawing in large part from the training I received as a spiritual director. So these practices of soulful presence and deep listening and deep awareness. And so that's what I'm exploring in that book, is how can, you know, each conversation we share is potentially sacred, and how can we become more aware of that sacred dimension and speak and listen from that truth.
There's an old quote, and I can't remember the source, but it's, you have two ears and one mouth. Listen, listen twice, speak once. I don't remember who said that.
I think that may be attributed to Aristotle, which in many ways you think, gosh, this Greek man from way back when, you know, but I've heard that attributed to Aristotle, who often said that to me, was my own father. So that's a very precious quote to me. Thank you.
And living in the world where sacred conversations, including especially sacred listening, is needed more than ever.
I wouldn't have imagined when I wrote this book in 2013 what would ensue in our lives over the, you know, in the 8 years since. I do remember I'd finished the book and I'd reached out to endorsers, Victor, and one of the wonderful endorsers that I had reached out to, Margaret Wheatley, wrote me back, and it was the weekend of the Sandy Hook. It was just on the heels of the Sandy Hook tragedy. And she said, Diane, I am so grateful for this book at this moment, which was probably the kindest thing I could have heard from any potential reader. So as I say, I just could have scarcely imagined the need for conversation. Now I so often get asked about, you know, in political, how do we navigate these political waters as potentially a sacred conversation? So that may be its own separate interview, but I just know how deep the need is. Whether it's racial relations, whether it's the pandemic with the reported levels of loneliness and isolation, there are just so many arenas where I see more and more of a need for this topic of conversation.
When we truly listen and truly hear what someone is sharing with us, are we giving them an opportunity to heal?
Oh, you just landed with my fundamental conviction. I think I just finished a conference presentation last week, Victor, and I talked about the role of watching as another person, their story unfolds, and watching as a loving witness. And I said, actually, that's all we need to do. I had other points I wanted to make in the presentation, but that's the essence. Being witnessed by one or more people, being listened to deeply, as you say, is the most profound healing we can experience. And as some of the theologian and wisdom figures I cite in my recent book say, you know, once we've been listened to in that way, we then have the capacity to compassionately self-witness. And we then bring that capacity to listen deeply to others. So it's not only healing, it's potentially transformative in what we then bring to our world.
Absolutely. Your second book, Deepening Engagement, Essential Wisdom for Listening and Leading with Purpose, Meaning, and Joy, suggests that effective leadership might evolve into an almost spiritual calling. What inspired this book, and how has this message been received?
So I kept hearing wonderful feedback, and people were asking for more after the first book. And so I spoke with my editor, and I said, what I think many of the folks, I was thinking of other educators and other leaders I work with in various sectors. And I thought, we now need a toolkit where it's not theologically specific. So my first book is Interfaith. It draws from a number of wisdom traditions. And so my challenge to myself to explore in the second book is, how can we engage soulfully but not use specific theological language? It was the hardest book I've written because my theological language is so significant and meaningful for me. And I wanted to be as inclusive as possible. I think I succeeded. I have a very dear colleague who told me I did use God once because I invoked the story, the Exodus story from the Hebrew scriptures. Mm. But I believe that's the only place where I have a theological referent. Otherwise, I'm trying to give metaphors and images and invitations that point to this deeper reality and invite people into awareness of this deeper reality, but in a way that we can each speak from the depth of our wisdom. So do I think I succeeded in that? I do. I've seen it. I've worked with the book in various settings. I think the thing I would have changed is it has an unusually long subtitle. And although we wanted to target leaders, what I think a lot of people missed is I view everybody has the potential to lead. You know, I was hoping to cultivate the capacity to lead rather than leadership as a role. So I would go back and I would change the subtitle of that book so that the title itself lent itself to greater inclusivity. Because I think some folks opted out. I have the privilege of you know, working with a lot of women's groups. And regrettably, there are some women who don't self-identify as leaders. And they're profound leaders in all kinds of capacities in their lives, but they may not yet see it as such. So that book is for them as much as for anybody who has a specific designated role.
Is it possible for spirituality and the workplace to be mutually inclusive?
Mutually inclusive. Well, why don't you say more about how you're using those words, Victor, so I make sure I understand what
in deepening engagement in leaders in workplaces and institutions and businesses, especially deepening their engagement with others. Is that something that the business world would welcome in your experience?
I see every indication that that is the case. I think that people are looking, you know, if they're going to spend however many hours a week or however many years of their life in work, I think they want to engage in such a way that their soul can show up as much as their intellect. So I do believe it's possible, and we do see evidence of this even in for-profit corporate settings. I think there are leaders who model the way of this. Now, what I can't speak to is I haven't occupied one of those roles personally. So the kinds of tensions that they navigate as they try to lead from that soulful place. I think the tensions are immense. But in truth, the tensions are always immense when we try to live from that place.
Absolutely. And perhaps off channel, you and I can discuss some of my experiences in the business world and the mixture of business and spirituality. My guest, Dr. Diane Miller, she's the author of Recreating a Life, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story. Diane, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Well, my book is published. It was actually the first publication of a new press. So Spiritual Directors International, based in Bellevue, Washington. This is the first publication of their new press. These are spiritual directors, for those of you that who may not know, are people who are committed to soul listening and increasing awareness of how the divine is at work in our lives. And so this, you can find the book there at their website, SDI World. You can also find it at Amazon. So those might be two of the places I would start by looking for it.
And your website, please.
And my website, my name, www.diane, I'm a 1N Diane. And then my last name, M-I-L-L-I-S, DianeMillis.com.
And we'll be back with more of Dr. Diane Miller and Recreating a Life after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The best of the holistic, spiritual, and conscious world. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization. Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad? Your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can. But it's just as important to take time for yourself. AARP can help. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Dr. Diane Miller. She's the author of Recreating a Life, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story. Diane, I learned of your work and your books after a colleague suggested that I join Spiritual Directors International. And we talked about spiritual direction, which you refer to as soul listening. Tell us about the nature of soul listening.
Well, I draw upon, there's a very beloved teacher in the Quaker tradition, Douglas Steer. And he says the most important thing we can do for another is to listen their soul into discovery and disclosure. And so when people ask me, what is spiritual direction and how is it different than, you know, counseling or coaching? And I just think Douglas Deere really summed it up best, that it's listening to that deepest part of our being, which, you know, often the term soul is used as a metaphor, and to listen that, to invite people to speak from that deep place and to discover their deepest truths, their deepest values, their deepest understanding of what gives their lives meaning. So it's the intention is not to do any direction. Actually, the name spiritual director is quite a misnomer, because if we're doing our jobs well, we're not directing. The soul is directing, and the deepest part of the other being is unfolding. So that's the way I think of what I do. And I think of it both professionally, because it is a profession that I practice when I meet both one-to-one for monthly sessions, when I meet to lead retreats, when I lead small groups where people accompany one another in this soulful way. But I also think of it's a type of presence I can bring into my everyday life. And at the end of the day, that's the true test. You know, like the Buddhists say, the true test of your time sitting is not on the cushion, it's what's happening off of the cushion. And the true test of my ministry is how I'm engaging with others in my everyday life. That's what I aspire to do, is to listen at this deeper level within me as I engage with another.
Please share with our listeners what a soul listening session would be like.
Well, I often invite, so we meet for 60 minutes. You may not find it surprising to know that in the past year, more and more of these meetings have been via Zoom, which I'm grateful for that platform. I invite directees to start the session in a way that is meaningful to them. And so they may bring a passage of poetry, they may bring a passage of scripture, they may opt to just sit in silence, or they may ask me to begin. But it's their session, and so I get to know more about the way spirit is at work in their lives by what they bring to start the session. So typically, you know, some kind of contemplative beginning so that they can bring their attention to what's going on within them. So about 5 minutes. And then people usually start with a story. It's either a story, something's going on at work, something's going on in their family. And that story then serves as the connective tissue for the rest of the session. So what I'm usually looking for is where's the movement, where's the energy, what's giving energy and what's limiting energy as they speak, and to invite them to explore both of those dimensions, because I think ultimately when we're discerning what's most sacred, the sacred works in our life in a life-giving, energy-giving way. In my tradition, we've got theologians in the Christian tradition about, you know, Jesus came that we live life and live it abundantly. And the spiritual life is a life that's fully human and fully divine, fully alive. So that's what I'm always listening for, is what's limiting that, and where are the points in the session where they seem to be connecting to that fullness of life, and just helping them to notice that. So if I'm doing my job well, it's like I'm holding up a mirror so that they can see themselves as they're being witnessed by another. And then we typically, at the end of the last 5 minutes, just return to silence and reflecting back. I often like to ask the question, what did you notice in today's session? What did you hear yourself saying that you'd like to remember? So the bookends are silence and reflection. And then the in between is really noticing, helping them to notice the movement of expansion and limitation. I'll stick with those two words for now.
Wonderful. Which leads us to recreating a life. What was the process of writing that book like?
I think it was the most joyful process of anything I've ever written. So if a true test of our vocation and calling is what we do with ease, then there's something very, very deeply connected to my calling in this work. It's not that it didn't take effort. It did take showing up each day. I think in many ways I could go back and I could look at passages and story I had written earlier in my life and pull them forward. So I think this book has been writing me for decades. But the actual writing from the time I got the contract to the time I turned it in was about a mere 4 months. So it was as you know, Victor, as a writer yourself, that's a pretty quick turnaround. And I decided on a method which felt risky. The method was that I knew I wanted to use guiding prompts. I wanted to use questions to invite people into reflection on their story that I use in retreats and I've used with students. So these are time-honored and time-tested, and they're usually very evocative for participants. So that part wasn't new. What was new is that I then pose the question and I respond to it from my own life story. And I wasn't sure if that was going to engage readers or not. I mean, certainly for my mother and certainly for my students, and, you know, they might find that really interesting. But for people who don't know me, would that be engaging to them? But I felt pedagogically as a teacher, it's important to model the kind of depth you want in a narrative. And I know enough from small groups that the person who goes first sets the tone for the others. So if I was willing to model appropriate vulnerability and tell my story with appropriate vulnerability, my hope was that readers then could better navigate how to do the same. And you notice how I'm using those words, appropriate vulnerability, because I do not think it's appropriate for, this isn't a Jerry Springer. You know, I think of the talk shows that people became so vulnerable and shared too much so that they felt stripped of everything. And I think that it's really important in this narrative sharing that we honor the core of our privacy. There are many things that I'll only share in prayer. And I believe that's the way it should be. We want to honor this private core within us. So then what does appropriate vulnerability look like? That was another dimension I was exploring in the book.
And a very, very wonderful, thoughtful, compassionate concern.
Indeed. I never want someone to walk away from a conversation or a small group or a class meeting and feel like they've shared too much. I want there to be a sense that they've been witnessed, that they've been celebrated, and they've been honored, but I don't want them to feel naked.
Wonderful. When someone first asks us to share our story, often the tendency is to start from our earliest childhood memories. In Recreating Life, you say that any story from any point can provide a portal. How so?
Yeah, and I actually want to credit David Drake, the author of Narrative Coaching, who called that to my attention. And once he introduced that assumption, I thought, this is true, because any story well told connects to the tapestry. If our lives are a beautiful tapestry, we pull on any string and it's all connected. So if you were to ask me, like I'm thinking recently of the events here we have witnessed in the city of Minneapolis, and it wouldn't take me too long when I talk about my experience over the past year of what I've witnessed in Minneapolis for me to get back to the story about my childhood. And you'd say, Diane, how on earth can the racial reckoning that has occurred around George Floyd trace back to your parents' divorce? Are you holding that question in your own mind right now, Victor?
Go ahead.
And I would say to you that this past year has shown me an undertold story in my own life, because for me, the story I had told for decades was the Mary Tyler Moore narrative. And for those that don't remember or aren't familiar with the Mary Tyler Moore narrative, Mary worked for a TV station. The show, the sitcom, was based here in Minneapolis. And I don't know if it was 5 seasons or 6 seasons, but that show aired in the 70s during a time when I had just moved away from Minnesota. So watching that show was my lifeline of hope. And moreover, as a young woman, you know, in the second wave of feminism, looking at the possibilities of being a working woman someday, Mary held up other narrative strands for me that gave me hope. So coming back to Minneapolis, I wanted to be like my beloved Mary, even though she was merely a television character. And how does this relate then to the past year? Well, I've often asked myself, what would Mary have to say about what's occurring in Minneapolis? Did Mary have any idea of the redlining? Did Mary have any idea of the racial inequities? These are things I have learned more about over the course of the past decades. Since back in the early 70s, I think they're things we've all learned more about. And so in my own mind, you know, I could tell you a story about this current event in my city and my feelings about it. And if you carefully listened, it's going to take me back to that core story as a girl. So I don't know how long that answer was, but it only takes a couple of minutes and we see how it connects to deeper core stories.
Thank you for sharing that. We sort of touched upon this in your practice, but when we share our stories, when we tell our stories, how does companionship come into play?
We did touch on it, but yes, thank you. I'd like to unpack that more. I think the best companions, first of all, are loving witnesses, right? They're holding up a mirror, and they're speaking about what they notice as they listen to us. So it may be something of, oh, Diane, I noticed how it sounded like you were getting tears as you spoke about the Mary Tyler Moore story and the George Floyd story. I could hear your voice was cracking a bit. That's one way of mirroring, is to give that nonverbal feedback. Another way of mirroring is to say, you know, I notice you seem to, your energy seem to deflate as you spoke about whatever it may be. So it's that very careful attentiveness to what is going on in the other person as they share the story. It's also very careful attentiveness to what's going on in us and what's stirring our own heart as we listen. So I think to convey what I call noticing what's moving in the other, noticing what's moving in me. We live in a world where we just tend to be so distracted, we really don't do a lot of noticing what's going on within us, and certainly don't do much noticing to what's going on in the other. So I think this is an aspect of companioning that, if it's up to me, I'm less interested in training people to become professional directors. And I just like to see more of our world grow in this capacity to notice, to really attend to one another.
Which brings us back to the quote that I shared in our introduction.
Yes,
if you light a lamp for someone else,
yes,
it will also brighten your path. Does sharing our story do the same?
My hope is, my experience is yes. Absolutely. And my hope is yes. I think what gives me the greatest hope is when I work with young adult college students and I see how hungry they are to be listened to. And and to share and to speak from their deepest truth. And then I hear them report that they can now go out after they've been listened to so deeply, they feel better equipped to go out and listen to their friends, not to give them advice, not to solve their problems, but just to practice this presence of being a witness to the other, a loving witness.
My guest, Dr. Diane Millis, her book, Recreating a Life, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story. We'll be back with more after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Imagine yourself being transported to India, to the banks of the Ganga and an ashram in Rishikesh. Visualize that you are welcome to satsang with an American sannyasi who shares the wisdom of her guru. Your visualization has manifested. Join Satvi Bhagavati Saraswati for inspiration and transformation every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese. And guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
I'm Kathy Williams, host of Sexy Mom Abundant Life radio show on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. On the show, we explore living abundantly in every area of your life. Ways to let go of limiting patterns and beliefs and to step into the flow of creativity and possibility, knowing you are supported by the universe.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week, Dr. Diane Millis. We're talking about her book, Recreating a Life, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Story. Growing up in the 1950s and 60s, before the advent of digital communication, social media, and the 24/7 cable news cycle, I remember intently listening to my parents, grandparents, uncles, and aunts sharing their stories and how that informed and shaped my growth and understanding. As a society, do we need to return to at least a semblance of this, especially with our children?
Oh, my. Do we ever? Do we ever? I hope that through some of this time in sheltering in place, that families have had more occasion. I know they've perhaps have to be separated from elders. But for parents and their children who had fewer extracurricular activities and such to race off to, I hope they had more occasion for this story sharing. And I think the beautiful use of this current technology is now we can Zoom and we can FaceTime and our elders can share the stories. Especially the stories of their struggles. I think that's perhaps what's most important. It's very easy to repeat, you know, the stories of how we succeeded. But I think what's really, really key is that we all take some risks of those vulnerable moments, lest we get the impression that our parents and grandparents didn't have their own sets of formidable struggles. So, yes, Victor, I am wholeheartedly on board of that gift. And I think my other hope would be then, what are some of the basic ways we can respond as listeners, even if we're as young as grade school children, just to encourage our elders to say more? And so what I introduce in Recreating are just three very simple responses. And I keep them simple because I believe they can be accessible for people of all ages. And so the three responses are, I noticed what we talked about in the last segment. Notice what you observed in the other. Notice what you observed in yourself as you listened. The second is, I appreciated. You know, here's what I learned from what you shared. I appreciated. I never realized you had to go through that. You know what? So building upon what you learned from the story with the hopes that the person may say even more. And then thirdly, I wondered, you know, what are the questions the story raises for you? So I offer that to our listeners today. You know, I noticed, I appreciated, I wondered, how can we bring those three very basic statements into more of our conversations? I think we'll see that it will enrich the responses from others.
Is it human nature when we share our stories with others to sort of color the story that we tell?
I think it's human nature. I think audience adaptation is human nature. And so I may tell a story differently depending on the audience, or if I wasn't trained in the way that I was trained, I may edit out certain things for certain age groups or certain backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. So I think audience very much shapes the way that we share stories. And I think the human nature, maybe we do one of two things. We overgeneralize where I either feel a need to put a silver lining on things, or we overgeneralize and we catastrophize. And so I think this awareness of a well-told story is not an overgeneralized one. It doesn't swing to either too much positive or too much negative. But that can really balance on both the positive and negatives. Just was finishing of an experience.
You share some wonderful exercises in Recreating a Life to help us get to our authentic story. Please share some of those with our listeners.
Once again, I need to ask you, Victor, how much time do you have? I'll tell you some of my favorites. I love to ask people to think about their story as a fairy tale. What would be the fairy tale story version of their story? And I have found this to be really open up new understandings of our narratives, because for many people, they've gotten so ingrained with a certain way of telling their story. And all of a sudden, this genre, I don't tell them, here's how you do it, here's the kind of characters you have. I just let their own imagination and own association with fairy tales guide them. And so the other day I was in a retreat and somebody was talking about her fairy G. And her fairy G is her code name for fairy godmother, which happened to be the way she was referring to the role of the spirit in her life. And so it's just very revealing how the use of imagination in fairy tales can help us touch into new dimensions. I've had people who've had really serious trauma who, after telling the story as a fairy tale, gained new insight and healing. So that's one. Did you want another, or should we?
Yes, please. Give us one more.
Sure. Another I really love is to ask people to think about who's the protagonist in your story. because both of these ways of storying invite us to speak in the third person. When I'm telling a fairy tale, I'm telling once upon a time there was a little girl or there was a woman, and I'm speaking about myself, but I'm doing it in the third person. And numerous studies have shown the benefits of speaking in the third person and recognizing our agency, that we have greater agency, we have greater choice making, rather than feeling like I can't do anything to change my circumstances. That third person perspective taking gives us a larger view of the activities in our life. So when I invite people to tell me the story of who's the protagonist and what is she seeking and what is limiting her? And how do you name that protagonist? I had a woman in a retreat recently, and with her permission, I can share this story. She said the name of her protagonist was Sore Thumb. And she was teased all the time. She always felt like she was an outlier. And for various reasons, she had a bodily condition that she was inordinately tall for her age group and for her sex. She also is a gay woman, and so she felt ostracized by her peers during her growing up years. She now feels like a sore thumb in her family because she's of one political persuasion and they're of another. And so I invited her that day as she shared that story of her protagonist. I mentioned to her, I said, I wonder, you have one thumb, but you have eight other fingers and one other thumb. What would you name them? And it didn't take her more than 10 seconds to list the way she would name those eight other fingers and thumbs. And they were all positive, life-giving qualities. So just to stand back, and rather than narrating her own experience in the way she'd been accustomed to speak at that level of third person about herself as a protagonist, as a character among other characters, helped her to see more life-giving dimensions at work.
Beautiful, beautiful. You have an exercise in which you ask, what is your life story in six words? And you share Thich Nhat Hanh's quote, I have arrived, I am home. Is this the way you feel?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure that I give credit where credit is due. And there is a website entitled The Six Word Story. I'm trying to look for that citation right now. But I'll give me a minute and I will look for that, because there is
no problem. I can edit the little gap out.
Can you edit that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
absolutely.
May I just take a moment while
absolutely, please. No, go ahead. I do this all the time. Absolutely.
Because I don't want to misappropriate taking credit for something that is not mine.
Absolutely.
Let me see. 32. Ah, yes, yes, yes. The Six Word Memoir Project. Should we pick back up there? Where do you want to go, Victor?
You can say that's based on the Six Word Memoir Project. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, Victor, that was inspired by the work of Larry Smith and his Six Word Memoir Project. So please look at all of the discovery he's made at his website, sixwordmemoirs.com. Now, you asked about my own six-word memoir.
Absolutely.
Yes. I have arrived. I am home. I think I have spent probably 5 decades of my life trying to arrive, trying to find the home that I had lost since the age of 10. So 4 decades, let's say. And there were various places where I've experienced home and belonging. Certainly my life with my husband, Mark, and our son has surpassed any home I could ever seek. It's been a true home for me. And yet, I think rather than an external location, I think when I say I am home now is because I am at home and at peace with making meaning, seeing coherence in the life I have lived. So I no longer feel like there's that phantom story that I'm living in comparison with. I feel I am fully engaged, all in with the story that I am living and the story that is living in me. So I am home in that.
Wonderful. And as I shared with you, I'm grounded in an ancient Hebrew expression that was taught to me by a wonderful mentor and teacher back when I was in the New Seminary of New York. And that is, everything is unfolding in divine order. And I truly believe that.
And Victor, now you, I'm going to be echoing that mantra of yours. Thank you for that.
And in Hebrew, Hakol Beseda, it's pronounced. So. My guest, Dr. Diane Millis, we talked about her book, Recreating a Life, Learning How to Tell Our Most Life-Giving Stories. Diane, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Yes. Well, you can find out more about me on my website, www.dianemillis.com. And you can get my book at Spiritual Directors International Press, which is wwsdiworld.org. You'll find a lot of great resources there. Or, of course, at booksellers such as Amazon.
Diane, thank you so much for joining us and sharing all of this wonderful work that you do.
It was my pleasure, Victor. Thanks so much for your life-giving invitation.
And thank you for joining us on Vox Novus. I'm Victor, the voice, Furman. Have a wonderful week.